I want to welcome you all. My name is Randy Armour. I'm an estate planning attorney. My practice is focused exclusively in the areas of estate planning, which is primarily trust, wills, powers of attorney, health care directives. I also do probate and trust administration. So if somebody passes away, I help the family go through those steps that are necessary to get assets transferred. One of my main goals is to teach people how to avoid probate, and that's through proper estate planning. That's what we're going to be talking about today. I have a local practice. My office is in Stevenson Ranch, just off the 5 freeway, near Lyons Avenue, across from the In-N-Out. Most people know where the In-N-Out is, in the 3-story red brick building. My goal when I meet with clients is to teach them how to save money for themselves and for their families. When I do presentations, another one of my goals is that everybody in the audience learn at least one new thing that they didn't know before they came to the presentation. I know we're all busy, and I really appreciate you taking the time. And I want to thank Brad, Nadine, Roger for allowing me to come here, Michelle, allowing me to come here to your house to present this information to you, and hopefully you all get something out of this presentation tonight. We're going to be talking a lot tonight about probate and ways to avoid probate. Has anybody ever been through a probate or know what a probate is? So we'll be talking about that. Probate is something that you want to avoid. Just keep that in mind. We're also going to be talking about taxes, different types of taxes, and how to avoid those taxes. And we're also going to be talking a little bit about protection of your assets for yourself and maybe even for your beneficiaries, for your children or the people you want to pass those assets down to. There are ways that we can protect assets for them and keep those assets, say, from their creditors or set it up so they're not going to squander the assets that you've worked your whole life to accumulate. So there's going to be a lot of information during the next hour or so. I just want you all to keep in mind that to make any of this work, getting the information is great, but another one of my goals is to get you past the step of just getting that information and actually take action, because you must take action to put this into place so that this actually does good for your family. Going to seminars, reading books, there's a lot of information on the web. I think that's all very important, but you also have to then do something with that information. Just a couple questions so I can kind of gear the presentation more toward what you want to hear. How many of you already have a trust today? How many have a trust? Oh, good. My clients do back there. Okay, good. Does anybody have a will? No trust, just a will. We're going to be talking tonight about the difference between wills and trusts. You already said nobody's gone through a probate, right? Well, that's good. How many of you have what's called an advanced health care directive? Okay, my clients again, good. So this is a very important document. There are a lot of things that you can do on your own and some things we'll talk about that you shouldn't try to do on your own. One of the things that you all should have, and you can do this on your own, is get what's called an advanced health care directive. Is anybody in the medical profession, associated fields? You are? So you've heard of HIPAA, right? The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It's a law that was passed, actually went into effect 5 or 6 years ago. It was a federal law that says that healthcare providers are prohibited from releasing any of your medical information to anybody without your authorization, right? So what happens if you're in the hospital, you're unconscious, your spouse shows up at the hospital, starts asking questions, what are the doctors supposed to tell them? I'm sorry, I can't release that information. Unless you have given that authority to the doctors, it has to be in writing, and that's what an advanced health care directive is. Remember Terry Schiavo, the lady in Florida? If she had had a health care directive, we would have never heard of Terry Schiavo. I know there are some parents who brought their children with them today, and if you have children over 18 years of age, it's extremely important that not only you, but your children also fill out these health care directives. Because if they're over 18, guess what, parents? You cannot get any information or make health care decisions for your children. It's called an advanced health care directive. You can go online. You can call my office. I can email it to you. It's a very simple document to fill out. All right, let's take a look at the packet that hopefully everybody got when you came in. Everybody or every couple should have received one. Is there anybody that didn't get a packet? Okay. So we'll open that up. And most of this we're not going to be going through as we do the presentation. It's just information for you to take home. On the left side, there is just a bio, talks a little bit about myself. I was raised, I was just talking to somebody, I've been in Santa Clarita since 1964. My parents bought a house out in Saugus, and so I grew up here, stayed out here. My kids have grown up here, met my beautiful wife here at Hart High School, and she's here today too. I don't think she's in the room right now. I'll introduce her as well. Went on to USC from Hart High School and then Loyola Law School. Under that, let's see, what do we have? Mine's kind of goofed up, but I think on the left side, there's a questionnaire, the green form. Does everybody have that green form? And then some a notes page. You can take that out, because if you put out the green form, if you want to meet with me, we'll collect that. And then the notes page, if you have any questions, we have a small group, but I have a lot of information. So I think it works best if you maybe write down your questions. If there's something you think you just can't wait to ask, you go ahead and raise your hand. But otherwise, it's going to be hard for me to get through the information in an hour. So if you just write down the questions, I'll stay as long as I need to answer any of your questions. On the right side, I used to write an article for a column in the Signal called It's Your Money, a business section that came out on Thursdays. They've discontinued the article, but they did ask me to write for that article. So I have a lot of the columns or the articles that I wrote. Then a practical guide to estate planning. This, again, is just information you can take home with you, which will cover a lot of the things we're going to discuss tonight. And there's actually a rate sheet down there at the bottom. So if you are interested, you can take a look at that later. Give you some idea of what the cost is if you want to set up an estate plan. Okay, but you don't need any of that stuff now. It's just for your information, and you can take that home later and take a look at that stuff. Let's go ahead and get started with the presentation, because like I said, there is a lot of information that I want to get through tonight. All right. Oh, this is just to remind me to let you know that on that green form, there are some boxes. I think there's about 19 boxes there, about two-thirds of the way down the page. And these are the topics I'm going to be discussing tonight. So as we're discussing, sometimes you'll see a little checkbox on the slide with a number on it that corresponds with one of those boxes. If you would like more information about one of those topics, I'm going to be going through this stuff kind of quickly, or if I meet with you, I'll be able to look at that and know what you're interested in so I can make sure I cover those things with you if we meet. This is just, I've been doing this for 15 years, and my practice has narrowed. This is all I do. So this is just my daughter, and I sit at the table. She's asking me why birds migrate, and my answer to her is, I'm sorry, honey, I don't know why birds migrate, but I can show you how to avoid probate. That's what I do. She was real excited about that. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a couple questions here. A will controls the distribution of all my property. Everybody already saw the answer, so nobody should get this wrong, right? False. Good. Good guess. A will controls the distribution of all my property. The answer is false. If you do have a will, the will generally will control the distribution of some of your assets, but not all. Most of us have things like life insurance policies or retirement accounts or properties that we own in joint tenancy with somebody. None of those properties will pass according to the instructions in a will, so you have to be careful if you only have a will, and we'll talk more about that. If you do have a will, that means that your estate doesn't go through probate. Now, we haven't discussed probate yet. Probate is the legal process of transferring the assets of a deceased owner. If you pass away, probate is a court process to transfer those assets. But if you have a will that says who gets your assets already, then that means you don't have to go through probate, right? How many think this is true? How many think this is false? And how many of you are never going to raise your hand no matter what? Just so I know. Okay, the answer is false. Most of you got that right. A will actually is nothing more than instructions for the probate court. I call a will a ticket to probate. Because if you pass away and we're going to transfer anything using a will, it has to go through probate, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. A lot of people think that they don't have to do estate planning because estate planning is only for rich people. I hear this all the time. I don't really have an estate, so I don't really need to do estate planning, right? Well, I already mentioned one area where everybody needs to do some planning, and this is considered part of estate planning. Remember what it was? The Advanced Healthcare Directive. So even if you're 18 and you have no assets, you still need an Advanced Healthcare Directive. That's part of an estate plan. There are also things like powers of attorney that everybody should have. If something happens to you, if you're incapacitated or even out of town, this is a document that can give somebody the right to handle your financial affairs for you. So everybody needs some type of estate planning, and a lot of times I can show people how to do it themselves for free, depending on what they need. I mentioned earlier that when I meet with clients, one of my main goals is to try to teach them how to save money for themselves and their families. And these are the areas in estate planning that are the potential costs that we like to show people how to avoid. Probate is a big one. We'll be talking a lot about probate, as I mentioned. Taxes. There are some tax issues involved with passing away or becoming incapacitated. Nursing home or long-term care costs. Is anybody here, are you acting as a caretaker for an elder family member? You probably know somebody who is, right? I am personally, I'm taking care of my aunt right now. She never had any children. My dad's only sister, she's only 73 years old, has had several strokes, and really can't do anything for herself. So fortunately, 20 years ago, she bought long-term care insurance. She's able to reside now in a very nice assisted living facility, and the long-term care insurance is paying for that 100%. If she didn't have that, this would have been a problem because the cost is growing every year for all of us. So if we don't want to be a burden on our families, we need to take a look at that. There are different ways to handle these costs we'll talk about. And the other potential cost is litigation. I was just reading something today, actually I was online, about the explosion in litigation in the area of trust. And a lot of that is due to the do-it-yourself type trust that we'll be talking about at the end here, the LegalZoom, Susie Orman, NOLO Press type trust. People think they can do this themselves. And when you'll see what we're going to be talking about that later on during the presentation, and you decide for yourselves if you think you can do this yourself. So let's talk a little bit about probate. What is probate? Probate is simply a way to change legal title if somebody passes away. So somebody owns a house in their name, they pass away. In this case, let's take an example. John Jones Sr. owns a house. He's a widower, and his wife has passed away. He has one son, and his goal is just to leave his property, his assets, to his son. So he does a will that says, I leave everything I have to my son, John Jr. He passes away. Okay, we know John's going to get the assets, but the house is titled in the father's name. How do we transfer that title to the son? Dad's gone. He can't sign the deed. Can the son sign the deed for him? No, he can't. Neither can anybody else without a court order. So that's what probate is. John Jr. would have to go through this court process and get authorized by the court to be able to sign for his father's estate to transfer that property to himself, even though he's the only child, and we know because of the will, and even if he didn't have a will, that he would be the one entitled to receive that property. So what's probate? It's the legal process by which property of a deceased owner is transferred to beneficiaries by a court. It's a court process, and the problem with probate or any court process is it generally takes a long time and costs a lot of money. So typically in California, you're looking at anywhere from 10 months to 18 months for a simple probate. Probates go on for years and years sometimes. I had a gentleman at a presentation a few months ago, and I asked if anybody had gone through a probate, and he said, yeah, I'm going through one right now. And I asked him, how long has it been since you started the probate procedure? He said, 7 years. So assets are tied up, and there's a lot of reasons why probates take this much time. Typically, though, the probate can be finished if it's a simple probate in a year or maybe a little less. But many probates go on year after year, and they're very expensive depending on the size of the estate. So let's talk about ways to avoid probate. Joint tenancy. Those of you who are married, probably if you have property, there's a good chance you hold title with your spouse, and if you do, it's probably in joint tenancy, right? Well, that's a way to avoid probate or joint bank accounts. So if you own an asset jointly with somebody, that will pass to the joint owner, joint account holder. If you hold it a joint tenancy by operation of law, that avoids probate. We'll talk about reasons you may not necessarily want to rely on joint tenancy as your only method of avoiding probate, however. Payable and death accounts and beneficiary designations. These would be the life insurance policies, the retirement accounts where you have beneficiaries named. If you have a beneficiary name and that beneficiary survives you, then those assets pass to those beneficiaries. They don't have to go through probate. That's actually the second biggest problem we see in estate planning, is people relying on beneficiary designations as their only method of estate planning and ways to avoid probate. I can't tell you how many times I've seen where somebody passes away. They have a life insurance policy. They have retirement accounts. We contact the life insurance company or the plan administrator, and these are policies they've had or accounts they've had for 20 or 30 years. They pass away. Guess who gets that money? The ex-spouse, their parents, whoever they named on the policy 20 or 30 years ago. They didn't update it. I've seen that many times with disastrous results. So if you are relying on these types of designations, make sure they're updated on a regular basis. Gifting. You can give all your assets away before you pass away. That would avoid probate. Well, there are problems with that you could probably imagine. We'll mention those briefly. But living trusts have become very popular in recent years. A living trust is a way to avoid probate, but you'll also see as we go through the presentation, the trust not only avoids probate, but avoids a lot of the problems we'll be discussing that are associated with these other methods of avoiding probate. Okay, when I meet with a client, one of the first things I do is I take a look at the assets, and I divide those assets into two categories, probate and non-probate assets. Probate assets are the assets that would be transferred using a will or by what are called the laws of intestacy. So most of you who, when I asked if you had a will or trust, didn't raise your hand, so I'm assuming you don't, you do have an estate plan. Everybody in this room has an estate plan, whether you know it or not, because if you don't have one that you've designed for yourself, the state has laws. We call those the laws of intestacy. Every state has them, and that decides who gets your assets if you pass away. Generally, the assets will all go to what are called your heirs at law. Those are your closest blood relatives, and sometimes that's what you would want anyway. So if you have a will, for example, that says, if I pass away, I leave everything to my spouse, and if my spouse doesn't survive me, everything goes in equal shares to my children, you already had that plan before you did the will, because that's what the laws of intestacy say. But those assets would require probate. It has to go through that long, expensive court procedure. Then there are the non-probate assets. These are the assets that would pass to other people based on the fact that they were held in joint tenancy, or they had beneficiary designations, or they were in a trust. Those are non-probate assets. I want to look over a quick case study, an example for you. Agnes Smith, 79-year-old widow, has a net worth of about $800,000. She has a house, some stocks, bonds, and bank accounts. Total about $800,000. Agnes has two adult children, and she just wants to leave her assets to her children in equal shares. So one of her goals is to avoid probate. If Agnes does nothing, what happens? The assets are going to have to be probated because they're all held in her name, right? So the kids are going to have to wait a year to a year and a half and spend several thousands of dollars. Just to give you an example of the cost of probate on an $800,000 estate, there are statutory fees in California that say what the attorney can get paid. It's 4% of the first $100,000, 3% of the next $100,000, 2% of everything over that, up to $1 million. So an $800,000 worth of assets, we have what? We have 7 and 12, right? $19,000 is what the attorney gets. The executor is entitled to the same fee as the attorney. There's another $19,000. And the court costs are typically about, let's say, $3,000 to $4,000. So we're up over $40,000, right, just in fees, just to get the property titled from Agnes's name into the names of her two kids. And it's going to take typically about a year to do that. So let's talk about what would happen if Agnes set up a trust. So we'll take a look at the Agnes Smith Trust. This trust is just a document that Agnes creates that contains all of her wishes regarding not only who is going to get her assets when she passes away, but who's going to manage those assets if she becomes incapacitated, and who's going to be in charge of managing the assets and making sure they get transferred to her children upon her death. So Agnes is going to put all these instructions. Agnes is going to name herself as what's called the trustee of the trust. The trustee is the person who has the authority to manage all the assets in the trust, and it's going to be Agnes. And during Agnes's life, it's going to say that Agnes can do anything she wants with those assets, just like she could before she put them in the trust. Nothing changes for Agnes. But what happens if Agnes passes away or becomes incapacitated? Then we have what are called successor trustees. These are the people who succeed or replace the trustee. In this case, Agnes's two children are both adults. They're both responsible. They get along. Agnes says, I'm going to name my two children as the successor trustees. Something happens to me. They step in. They take care of the assets. Upon my death, they just go ahead and distribute the assets to themselves. It's very simple. It's very easy if the trust is done correctly. No probate. The reason there's no probate is when Agnes sets up this trust, that's the first step. The second step is called funding the trust. Agnes is going to change the way she holds title to her assets. Instead of holding title to her house as Agnes Smith, a widow, she's going to change it to Agnes Smith as trustee of the Agnes Smith Trust. She does a simple deed to change the way she holds title. Now her trust holds the legal title to that property, not Agnes. So if Agnes passes away, the trust owns the property. And can a trust die? No. When is probate required? Probate's only required when the legal owner of the assets passes away. So if Agnes transfers the assets to the trust, when she passes away, the trust continues to own the property. Therefore, there's no probate required. Her children simply step in and take over as the managers or trustee of that trust. The trustee authorizes them to act on behalf of the trust to transfer the assets out of the trust to the beneficiaries, who are once again the children. They can do this very easily, very quickly, very inexpensively. I have done a trust administration of an estate of about $1 million. It took me about 2 hours to transfer the real estate. I just told it, in this case, there was one beneficiary who was an only child who was also the trustee. I did the real estate paperwork. I told her to go to the broker who had the Merrill Lynch account, which was in the trust, take him a death certificate, and he would transfer that account into her name. It was done. She owned the assets. It was that simple. No spending $40,000 or a year in court to get the assets transferred. That's one of the biggest advantages of having a trust, probate avoidance. So a living trust can be single, like in Agnes's case, or it can be a joint trust. So the typical situation, husband, wife, first marriage, they have kids together, and they just want to leave everything to the kids. If they do nothing or they have a will, typically there's no probate required in that situation on the death of the first spouse. Everything will pass to the surviving spouse. But then upon the death of the second spouse, there would still be a probate necessary, even though they held those assets jointly while both of them were alive. So in this case, we'll set up a joint trust, usually for the husband and wife. Husband and wife are co-trustees, and usually it's set up so that either of them can manage the assets, kind of like a joint bank account. So as long as either the husband and wife is alive, they're going to be the trustees. Upon the death or incapacity of the second spouse, then same situation. Successor trustees step in, manage the assets, and distribute those assets to the beneficiaries. A very important step, if you have a trust, I mentioned earlier that beneficiary designations, payable and death designations, that's usually the second biggest mistake we see in estate planning. The biggest mistake, usually with people with trusts, is not funding the trust. If you set up a trust, you're going to have all these instructions on how you want your assets managed and distributed. Those instructions will only apply to the assets that are owned by the trust, however. That's why when Agnes set up her trust, I said we would change the way she held title to her house. We actually record a deed so that the title is held in the name of the trust. If we don't do that, the house is not in the trust, and the trust doesn't apply. So we have to fund the trust. We have to transfer assets into the trust. Which assets do we transfer into the trust? Well, usually pretty much all the assets. There are some exceptions. The primary exception usually is retirement accounts. If you have 401ks, IRAs, those can't be owned by the trust. They have to be owned by you personally. Under certain circumstances, we would want to name the trust as a beneficiary, however. So even though it can't be held in the trust during your lifetime, the typical situation, if you're married, we'll name your spouse as the primary beneficiary. name the trust as the alternate beneficiary. So it goes directly into the trust to be managed and distributed according to the terms of the trust upon your death. Funding the trust is extremely important. And I see this all the time where people come into me, their parents, let's say, have passed away, and they bring in the parents' trust, and at least they're relieved they don't have to go through probate. I pull the deed on the property. Guess what? The house is not titled in the name of the trust. They say, well, what does that mean? I say, well, unfortunately, that means we have to go through probate, because typically if you have a trust, you also have a will. We call those wills pour-over wills, because that will is just going to say, upon my death, the beneficiary of my estate is the trust. So it just pours everything into the trust after your death that you didn't have in the trust during your life. But remember what I said about a will earlier? A will is nothing more than instructions to the probate court. Even if we're using the will to transfer assets into the trust, we have to go through probate to get the assets into the trust, which was designed to avoid probate, right? So it kind of defeats the purpose. We do this all the time. It's extremely frustrating for me and even more frustrating for the family. There is a way to avoid probate in most cases if assets are not put in the trust. And this goes back to a 1992 case in California called the Estate of Hegstead. In that case, the California Court of Appeals ruled that if you have a trust and you pass away and you left assets out of the trust, essentially it says that if there is sufficient instruction in writing that, or declaration in writing that your assets do belong to the trust. Oh, thank you very much. You were reading my mind. That if you did have assets left out of the trust, but you had a declaration stating those assets do belong to the trust, and there was a very recent court case that was just decided out of Ventura County by the Court of Appeals that ruled it can be a general assignment. It doesn't have to list specific assets. It can say, in that case, it was stocks. They had an assignment that said all stocks that I own belong to the trust. The court ruled that's sufficient to move stocks that were outside of the trust in the trust. So no probate was necessary. Most people don't have that documentation, though. I've reviewed hundreds of trusts over the last 15 years. A very small percentage have those types of declarations to allow us to transfer assets into the trust, so we have to go through probate. I have another case that I'm dealing with right now, which was also in Ventura County. Everything was in a trust, but about 6 months before this gentleman passed away, he moved some money out of his brokerage account into another account at Charles Schwab, did not title that account in the name of the trust. We're having to go through probate just to get that one account into the trust. Would not have been necessary if he had had what I call a comprehensive transfer document or a general assignment to transfer those accounts, that account into the trust. But I don't want you to think that, for instance, if I did your estate plan and you have this general assignment, comprehensive transfer document, that then it doesn't matter if your assets are actually titled in the name of the trust. Because even using that document, it still requires a court procedure, but it's much easier, quicker, and less expensive than probate. Okay, so let's talk about other ways to avoid probate. Remember I had a list up earlier, different ways to avoid probate. Joint tenancy with one was one. So why not just use joint tenancy? If you're married, you put your assets in joint tenancy. One reason is, well, that's fine if the first spouse passes away, but upon the death of the second spouse, it's still going to require to be probated before it goes to your beneficiaries. People say, well, if something happens to my spouse or I, then the survivor can do the planning. Well, that's great unless there's a joint accident or the surviving spouse is incapacitated. And, of course, the surviving spouse is generally grieving, and that's usually not a good time to do this type of planning. And also the deceased spouse's interests may not be represented because they have no input now on what the trust is going to say. There are also some tax benefits that could be lost if you wait to plan until after one spouse passes away. We'll talk more about those later. Another thing people do is they say, okay, the way I'm going to take care of this is I'm just going to add the children on as joint tenants. Now, even if we both pass away or if I'm not married, if I pass away, now it's going to automatically go to the children and avoid probate, right? That's true. It will go to the surviving joint tenants, whether it be your spouse or non-spouse. But here's the problems. If you're a parent and you put your child on title, guess what? You've just lost control of that property. What if you want to sell it or refinance it? You have to get your kids' permission, and your child has to agree to do that. I've had a situation where a lady put her 5 adult children on title to the house. She had lost her husband and just wanted to make sure they got it. She wanted to sell that property a couple of years later and move into a retirement community. One of her 5 children, one of her sons, says, no, I don't want to sell the house. This is a house I grew up in. We want to keep this house. You can't sell it. She couldn't sell it. Property could be exposed to the debts of the children. If you add them as joint tenants, they own that property. What happens if your child gets sued or has medical bills or other creditors coming after them? Guess what? You've just exposed your assets to your children's creditors. So you got to be very careful about this. I've seen this happen too with pretty disastrous results on real estate and on bank accounts as well. If you add a child on title to your primary residence and that child doesn't live in the house, there's a potential loss of the personal residence exemption. So if you sell that house and it's your primary residence, you can exempt if you're married up to $500,000, if you're not married up to $250,000 in capital gains on the sale of the house. You may be losing some of that exemption if you add somebody on title who doesn't live in the house. Okay, so one of the benefits of a trust is avoiding probate. Let's talk about some of the other benefits. Management of assets. Now, this is for you and for your beneficiaries. If you have a will is what's called a testamentary document. So you've probably heard the term last will and testament. That term testament means arising or becoming effective upon death. It's Latin. A will is just that. It's a document that only becomes effective when you pass away. So what happens if you have a will and you become incapacitated? The will doesn't allow anybody to step in to manage assets for you. It just determines who's going to get those assets when you pass away. So if you become incapacitated, you should make sure if you have a will that you also have another document called a durable power of attorney for financial matters. But if you have a trust, the trust takes care of that for the assets in the trust because it says my successor trustees, the people who are going to replace me to manage this trust, can take over upon my death or also upon my incapacity in most cases. And there are also some other things like resignation or disappearance. So if you can no longer manage your assets, somebody could step in to manage the assets for you without having to go to court and have to go through what we call a conservatorship, which is another long, expensive legal procedure to allow somebody to manage your assets. Sometimes we refer to that as a living probate. So assets could be managed for you if you become incapacitated, but also for your beneficiaries, for your children. If you have minor children and you leave them assets outright, and they don't even have to be minor children. They can just be children that you're not sure have the experience or responsibility to be able to handle your assets if something happens to you. Somebody said they had read, I hadn't seen this, a financial advisor actually said they had read something recently that said that most inheritances are gone within 18 months. So a lot of times what we'll do is set up what are called testamentary trusts, trusts that become effective after you pass away so that assets can be managed for your beneficiaries over a period of time. And if you have any beneficiaries that have any special needs or disabilities, it is very important that you talk to somebody who's knowledgeable about special needs trusts so that we can leave assets to aid those beneficiaries and allow them to get things that they need without jeopardizing their ability to continue to receive public benefits. Because if you just leave assets outright, they're going to lose all their public benefits. So that's very important. Protection of minor children. Another thing that the trust does, it designate guardians for minor children. And once again, also decide, you get to decide who's going to manage the assets and how long those assets are going to be managed. Privacy. This is another issue that people don't think about often, but if you have a will and you pass away or you don't have a will and your assets have to go through probate, doesn't matter, that probate process is public. So what happens is somebody has to file a petition with the court that gets filed with the superior court in the county where that person passed away, and that's what starts the probate process and starts the process of somebody being named as the executor or administrator of the estate to be able to manage it. Once those petitions are filed, who can go down to the courthouse and pull those petitions? Anyone is right. It's public. And people do this every day. They go down to the courthouse, they pull the probate petitions for that day. They know who died. Not only that, eventually they're going to know who the beneficiaries are because the will has to be filed with the court too. And they're going to know what all the assets are and what the value of those assets are and who's going to be getting all those assets. And you can probably imagine there's reasons that people would want to know this information. So we hear about these celebrity cases. You know, Jackie O, who died in New York, she had a will. Everything was public. And then we see cases like the Michael Jackson case. Michael Jackson had a trust. Now, if you have a trust, he also had a pour-over will. The will does have to be filed with the court, and you probably saw the reporters clamoring down at the Santa Monica courthouse to get that will when it was filed. Well, what did the will say? All the will said is he left everything to his trust. The trust doesn't get recorded or filed anywhere. So that's why we're not hearing a lot about who's getting Michael Jackson's assets, because it's all private. So a trust keeps your affairs and the affairs of your beneficiaries private, so they won't be hounded by people who are trying to sell them things or hassling them to hire them to do something, because they know what assets they're going to get. Oftentimes, because of that issue where it keeps your affairs private, usually a trust is more difficult to contest or challenge because it's not public knowledge. Does anybody own property outside of California? Okay. If you own property in other states, I'll just mention this quickly then. Every state has different probate laws. So if you own real estate outside of California and you pass away, not only will there be a probate here under California law, there will be a separate probate in every state you own property under the laws of that state. So if you have a trust, we can put the trust in any state, or the property rather, of any state into this trust. It avoids probate in all states. Okay. So if trusts are so great, why doesn't everybody get one? Well, this is what I found in my 15 years of talking to people and doing these presentations. These are the main reasons why people don't already have trusts. A lot of it is just lack of awareness. It's just there's a lot of information out there. There's also a lot of misinformation out there. And almost everybody in this room, if I ask you, if you don't have a will or trust, it's something that's probably been on your mind for a long time, right? Everybody I meet says either we've already got a trust set up or we've been thinking about that for years. We have to get that done. They're just not sure how it works, who to go to. It's just sometimes lack of awareness. A lot of times people just don't understand this concept of a trust, and they've heard that they have to transfer assets into this trust, so they fear losing control or management of their assets. Actually, if the trust is set up right, you gain control. During your life, you're going to have the same powers you had to manage those assets before you established the trust. And after you put your assets into the trust, you're going to decide who's going to manage those assets if you become incapacitated upon your death. So you've actually gained control over those assets that you didn't have before. People have heard about funding the trust, that the assets have to be transferred in the trust, and that scares them. Just that process. You mean I have to transfer all my real estate, my bank accounts, everything into the trust? And typically the answer is yes, you do. It's a very simple process. I was talking to Brad and Nadine earlier, and they were just telling me that they just finished this process, and it was very easy to get the assets into the trust. Affordability. A lot of people think that there's a big difference between doing a will, a trust. If you do it correctly, actually the trust is a lot more affordable for yourself and your family. We have not only the probate avoidance, so potentially in Agnes's case, we've just saved her family somewhere around $40,000. And also, there are some tax issues we'll be discussing. To get these tax issues dealt with in separate wills is sometimes even more complicated than doing it correctly in a trust. So in very simple estates where you don't need any estate tax planning, then the trust is going to be more expensive, but it has all these other benefits too. So in the long run, it's actually going to save money. But this is the number one reason why you don't all have trust, right? Once again, you know you need to do something, and it just somehow doesn't get put on your to-do list for the next day ever, and so we just procrastinate. We push it off. That's one of the things that I'm going to try to get you to get over today is procrastination. So we'll try to get you over that hump and get to the point where you're ready to take action to put some of these things in place to protect your assets and your family. Taxes. This is another reason people do estate planning. There's different types of taxes that we look at as estate planners. There's the estate tax, the income tax, which is generally in estate planning. We're looking at capital gains tax, gift tax. Here's a slide, this gentleman showing his son his beautiful spread, saying, son, one day 60% of this is going to be yours. I'm sure the son was real excited to hear that, because a lot of times Uncle Sam ends up being one of the biggest beneficiaries of our estate. We can avoid that in most cases. So let's take a look first at the federal estate tax. In 2008, we actually had a $2 million exemption from the federal estate tax. The federal estate tax, commonly referred to as the death tax, is a tax that the federal government imposes upon the value of all your assets when you pass away. So you can't necessarily avoid taxes even by dying, because they want to come and tax the assets that you owned when you passed away. In 2008, we had a flat rate of 45% of anything over $2 million. I could go back and show you all the changes that have occurred over the last 15, 20 years, but I'm going to limit it just to the past few years here. In 2009, the exemption was raised to $3.5 million with the flat rate of 45%. In 2010, we had an interesting situation. This was last year, where there was no federal estate or gift tax. It was repealed based on a law that went into effect back in 2001 that was intended to be a 10-year phase out of the estate tax. President Bush, when he was running in 2000, said one of his goals was to do away with this federal estate tax. He said it's double taxation. We shouldn't be paying tax on money we already were taxed as income tax. So he got Congress to pass a bill which was supposed to be a 10-year phase-out. They didn't have quite enough votes to make it a permanent bill, so they added a sunset provision, which said that law only lasts for 10 years, so they did get it passed. So in 2011, the bill went into place, phasing out the tax over a 10-year period. 2010 was the 10th year. There was no federal estate or gift or generation skipping tax. Actually, there was a gift tax still, but not a generation skipping tax. And the top gift rate went down to 35% from 45. This year, there's a 2 over there somewhere, the estate tax actually came back. And if Congress had not done anything, it would have come back with only a $1 million exemption this year. However, on December 17th, Congress passed a bill which allowed the estate tax to return, but they raised the exemption to $5 million per person. So not many people right now under the current law are going to be affected by the estate tax. And they lowered the tax rate to a flat 35% to bring it in line with the top federal income tax rate. So that's great news, right? And the other thing that they did, which we've never had before, was they added what's called a portability provision to the tax bill. So it says not only is each person entitled to a $5 million exemption, but if you're married, in most cases, if one spouse passes away and all the assets pass to the surviving spouse, the deceased spouse's exemption also passes to the surviving spouse, so the surviving spouse has a $10 million exemption when they pass away. Okay, but as you see here, this says this is only for 2011 and 2012. What happens to 2013? If Congress does nothing before 2013, we will go back to having only a $1 million exemption without the portability provision, meaning you can't transfer your exemption to your surviving spouse. So in most cases, the surviving spouse would only have a $1 million exemption. Everything over that would be taxed up to a maximum rate of 55%. So the reason for this is this bill they just passed with the $5 and $10 million exemptions was part of the bill that extended the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years. So when that expires, this also expires. We don't know what's going to happen a year and a half from now at the beginning of 2013. We are expecting and we are hopeful that Congress will continue to extend the current law with the $5 million exemptions, and that also has a cost of living increase built in. That would be great, but we can't necessarily count on that. So when we look at somebody's estate and we're going to plan that estate, we have to keep this in mind, that these laws are going to change, and worst case scenario is we default back to the old law, so we have to take that into consideration. There are things that we can do to ensure that if we do go back to the old law or whatever the law becomes, that we can utilize both spouses' exemption even without the portability option by setting up something called an AB trust, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So a couple of notes on the federal estate tax. There is no tax if you pass away and your assets go to your spouse. So you can leave an unlimited amount to your spouse. The tax would then be deferred until the death of the second spouse. If you're under whatever the exclusion is, there's no tax. Typically, the tax rates on anything over the exemption amount are the highest tax rates that we have. They were as high as 55%. They've been brought down to 35%, which is the lowest we've seen in many, many years. So I know that we're getting a little technical here with the tax issues, but I want to explain that if you're going to try to do this yourself, you have to understand all of this stuff and understand the possible changes that are going to take place in the tax laws and understand the options that you can put into these trusts. So one of the options that we will generally put in a married couple's trust is options that allow the trust to be split into two separate trusts, or sometimes we'll make that split mandatory upon the death of the first spouse because there are also non-tax reasons why people would want the trust to be split sometimes. One of those non-tax reasons may be it's a second marriage and you each have children from a prior marriage. And you just have a sneaky suspicion that if you pass away first, your spouse may decide not to leave your children anything. And if everything stays in the same trust and they could change it, then you would have obviously no control over that. So sometimes we'll set up a trust that splits. Half that trust becomes irrevocable upon the death of the first spouse. So the surviving spouse can still do what they want with their half, but we've locked in the plan of distribution for the other half. We have situations where a spouse passes away, the surviving spouse remarries, and the children end up getting nothing. So this is a way to at least ensure that part of the assets are going to go to the children if you pass away first. Those are non-tax reasons, but there are also tax reasons why we split the trust in some cases. We've done this in the past and may have to do this in the future, and that has to be with one spouse passing away, and we lose the portability provision that allows the deceased spouse's exemption to pass to the surviving spouse. The only way then to save the deceased spouse's exemption is by splitting the trust into what we call an AB trust. The B trust would hold the deceased spouse's share and would be able to utilize their exemption. Then the surviving spouse has another full exemption to use when they pass away. Whether or not this is going to be necessary, we don't know. For tax purposes, it may still be necessary for other reasons. But I like in a lot of cases we want to at least explore that with all of our clients. And sometimes we'll put in a trust that contains an option, that maybe there is no non-tax reason to do this, but not knowing what the tax laws are going to be or the size of the estate's going to be in the future, we'll put it in there so that the surviving spouse will then have the option to split the trust into two trusts or not, depending on the situation and the laws at that time. So this just is an example of how we can split the trust up rather than leave all the assets directly to the surviving spouse. We would split it up into two trusts. If we did this, the second trust that holds the deceased spouse's share of the estate is typically referred to as the bypass or exemption. I call it a credit shelter trust. And usually, the surviving spouse is the trustee of that trust, too. The surviving spouse can still be given the right to manage all the assets and to use the assets if they need those assets during their lifetime. Most of us own life insurance, I would think, and when we're talking about estate tax, a lot of people say, even if we go back to the $1 million exemption, it's not going to affect us. We're not going to have over $1 million of assets. We have a house. Well, that house, of course, could appreciate 20 years from now. We have no idea what it's going to be worth. And then I'll ask them, do you own life insurance? Oh, yeah, we each have a $1 million policy. Well, guess what? The death benefit on that life insurance, if you own that policy, is taxed as part of your estate when you pass away. So if you have $500,000 of assets and a $1 million life insurance policy, you're taxable. Estate for estate tax purposes is $1.5 million. So the death benefits, if you own the policy, are includable in your taxable estate. We do things like set up trusts that remove that life insurance death benefit from your taxable estate. It's just one of the options that we need to look at. Most people right now, because of the tax laws, may not have to do that, but at least we want to explore that with you. There's also, besides the estate tax, a gift tax. It's actually, the gift and estate tax are a unified tax. They're a combined tax, and they work together. For the gift tax, you can give up to $13,000 a year to anybody you want. You've probably heard that. It used to be 10, now it's 13. If you give somebody over $13,000 in any given year, now that excess is taxed as part of the gift tax. Most people don't know how that works. Most people never actually pay the tax. If you give somebody $113,000, $100,000 is taxable. That doesn't mean you have to pay the tax in most cases. It means when you pass away, instead of having, say, a $5 million exemption from the estate tax, you only have a $4.9 million exemption. So it's just part of that tax that you're using up that exemption during your life. But that is, the gift tax does avoid wealthy people from giving all their assets away before they pass away to avoid the estate tax. Because as they're giving gifts away, it's reducing their exemption. So if they give away $5 million during their life under the current law, they would have no exemption for their other assets when they pass away. Everything else would be taxed. Okay, and I know I'm running a little long. I'm going to try to wrap up quickly, but this is important. Another tax we look at is the capital gains tax. So this is another reason you don't necessarily want to give assets away, and I see people doing this all the time. In this case, let's say Dad just found out he has some terminal illness, and he has a piece of property that he paid $100,000 for, which is now worth $700,000. And he decides he's just going to give this property to his son. He's just going to transfer it to him now because he knows he's not going to be here long anyways. The son doesn't have to go through probate because he already owns it, so he just gives it to him. He says, my assets are under $5 million. There's no gift tax. I'm not worried about that. So he just titles it in his son's name. So now that asset is worth $700,000. Dad passes away. The son sells the property. Well, if you give an appreciated asset during your lifetime, you're also giving that person what's called your tax basis. So that $100,000 that Dad paid for the property becomes the son's tax basis. So when he sells the property for $700,000, he's going to have a $600,000 capital gain, which is taxable income to the son. Whereas if Dad had just set up a trust and put the house in the trust and left it to his son when he passed away, the son would get what's called a step-up in basis on that property. So the basis becomes whatever the value of the asset is upon Dad's death. If it's worth $700,000 and the kid sells it for $700,000, what's the gain? Zero. So there's zero tax. He just avoid paying tax on $600,000. That's another reason you have to be careful about giving away appreciated assets. This is also true, the capital gains issue for married couples. And this I see a lot. Married couples holding title to their properties as joint tenants, which used to be and still is a very common way to hold title. But there are some tax implications. If you're married and you hold title to your house, husband and wife, as joint tenants, let's say you bought the property for $100,000, which is now your tax basis, and now the current market value is, once again, $700,000. If one spouse passes away and it's held in joint tenancy, the surviving spouse will get a one-half step-up in basis on the appreciation. So it's gone up $600,000. The basis is moved up $300,000. So now the tax basis is $400,000. The surviving spouse sells the house for $700,000. They still have a $300,000 capital gain. Now, if it's the primary residence, under current law, the surviving spouse would still get a $250,000 exemption, so there'd only be $50,000 that was taxed. But what if it goes up another $200,000 before they sell it? They continue to live in the house, they sell it, and so now they're going to have to pay tax on all of the additional appreciation. Whereas, if that couple, instead of holding title as joint tenants, had transferred it or transmuted, it's called, or changed the character of the property to community property from joint tenancy, upon the death of the first spouse, the surviving spouse gets a full step up in basis. Now, one spouse passes away and the surviving spouse sells it for $700,000. $700,000 is their basis. There's zero gain, there's zero tax. Now, they would still have, if they continue to live in the house, another $250,000 exemption over and above that if they don't decide to sell the house right away. So how you hold title to your property can have tax implications. Most people don't realize that. Long-term care issues is another area that we like to look at for clients that is oftentimes overlooked. I'm just going to say briefly, there are some provisions in trust that I rarely see that can be very helpful in allowing what we call Medicaid planning or Medi-Cal planning here in California to perhaps allow assets to be transferred by somebody on your behalf if you become incapacitated, or different things can be done to avoid those assets being wiped out if long-term care is necessary. I've seen some statistics recently that say up to 70% of us are going to need some type of long-term care before we pass away. And how is that care going to be paid for? And by the way, if you have to go into a skilled nursing facility or nursing home in California, the cost is at or just above right now, on average, $100,000 a year for that care. So if you have assets, you have to use your own assets. Your health care insurance doesn't cover this. Medicare will generally cover long-term care. If you go into a nursing home from the hospital for the first, say, 100 days, then you're on your own. Does anybody have long-term care insurance? Usually not. Nobody in here has it. There is insurance. This is the insurance my aunt bought when she was 53 years old, 20 years before she started having these strokes, which allows her to be in this really nice assisted living. There is insurance that can be purchased to cover this kind of care. Most people don't have it. You might want to look into it. I don't sell any types of insurance, by the way. You can talk to your financial advisor. I can refer you to somebody who sells that type of insurance. I don't sell any insurance products, but I think it's something that you should at least look into, because if you don't have private insurance, then you have to private pay out of your assets until those assets run out, and then Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California will step in, but in most cases, your assets are gone. We can put some provisions in the trust which could help, if you become incapacitated, allow your trustees to organize your assets or do things for you that could save those assets for the beneficiaries rather than all of those assets being wiped out. And the final area that I mentioned earlier where I like to show people how to save money is litigation. This is just a quote that I found a few months ago. I was reading something. This is from around 1900 by this author, that death is not the end. There remains the litigation over the estate. And as I mentioned earlier, this is becoming more and more prevalent today. We are in a very litigious society, so if you do estate planning, you want to make sure that it's done by a professional who knows what they're doing, so your wishes are actually going to be carried out. I've been involved with a lot of trust litigation, and in most of these cases, the person went to their grave thinking they had set up a trust so everything was taken care of. I could probably do another 10-hour seminar just on the litigations I've seen and how to avoid these litigations. The best way to avoid litigation is have an experienced attorney who not only is an experienced attorney, but experienced in estate planning, draft your documents for you. So if you do a trust, there are several other documents that you need to be coordinated with the trust to make this work right. Durable powers of attorney, health care directives, community property agreements, in many cases, pour over wills, certificates. Funding is very important. Somebody has to help you or show you how to get the assets into the trust. Typically, we'll do all the real property for you. Think about your current plan. And remember, you all have a current plan, either one you've designed yourself or one designed for you by the laws of California, the laws of intestacy. Does your current plan really carry out your wishes, minimize costs, reduce time delays? Does it minimize the tax liabilities? Does it maximize privacy? Does it provide for management of your assets? So who should do your estate plan? I just mentioned it should be done by an experienced estate planning attorney, and there must be a personal meeting between you and the attorney, not a paralegal, not an assistant. It's an attorney who knows how to spot the issues and is trained to gather the necessary information and look at the issues that will apply to your specific set of circumstances. Make sure that all your documents are state-specific and coordinated. So if you buy a general trust package that's sold throughout the country, chances are every state has specific laws. Those documents aren't going to be state-specific. Is the drafter insured? If something's wrong, does the drafter have malpractice insurance? Is there an upfront discussion of all the fees, including funding the trust? Is there help with transferring your assets into the trust? Remember we talked about funding the trust? A lot of times that's the problem. People just don't know what to do. And I've seen many cases where they have this trust document, but it means nothing because there's nothing in the document. Making changes. Who's going to help you if the trust has to be changed? If there's a middleman, and I see this all the time, somebody's calling or coming to your door trying to sell you a trust, you want to look out for that. There's a lot of scams out there, which we're going to be talking about in a minute. So beware of trust scams. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. If you hear about a trust that can be used to reduce or eliminate your personal income taxes, it's probably a scam. Okay? Trusts don't do that. There are certain types of trusts that are marketed out there that are supposed to be able to reduce your income taxes or protect your assets. There are some trusts that can help protect assets, but be very careful about the people who are pushing those trusts. They're very specific trusts for specific purposes, and they have to be done correctly. They're usually very expensive to set up as well. Look out for what we call trust mills. Trust mills are trusts that are done by people where there is no attorney that you meet with. And oftentimes, people will say, well, I didn't meet with an attorney, but they said an attorney looked over the documents. And there's some attorney's name on there. Be very careful. It's usually these trusts for a limited purpose, like avoiding probate. And oftentimes, they will avoid probate if they're funded, but they don't cover any of these other things that we talked about today. Usually, it doesn't cover any type of funding. So you get a document, but it's not funded. There's nothing in it. And of course, usually they're very cheap because all they're doing is selling you documents. There were a couple trust mills out there for many, many years. Alliance for Mature Americans, Family First Advanced Estate Planning. I actually met with a financial advisor last year. I get called all the time by financial advisors who want to meet with me to try to get some kind of arrangement going where we can refer clients back and forth. Well, this financial planner came into my office and I met with him, and I don't refer anybody to anybody unless I have a personal relationship and I'm very comfortable with them. I won't give anybody their name. He mentioned to me that he knew a lot about trust because he used to work for Family First Advanced Estate Planning. Well, Family First Advanced Estate Planning is out of business. Not only that, I've been certified by the California State Bar as a speaker for elder abuse. I've taken some special training, and the state bar, in their presentation that they give us if we do a presentation on elder abuse, contains certain information that they want us to tell people about, and one of us is about these trust mills, and they, in their presentations, mention specifically Family First Advanced Estate Planning as a form of elder abuse that was designed to gather information about elderly people to sell them annuities or things that they didn't need and the estate planning was kind of a lost leader. It's something, but they weren't attorneys. They weren't qualified to sell trusts in the first place. So be very careful about who's trying to sell you a trust. And then there, of course, are the do-it-yourself plans. And I was just, actually, I just did this slide today. I just made this up today because I was thinking about this and I was looking at some of this, and I see these do-it-yourself trusts all the time, and they have some things in common. One is there's obviously no meeting with an attorney, so there's some kind of checklist that you're supposed to fill out. It's a self-evaluation. You're doing it yourself. Do you know what you need to look for to cover all of these issues we discuss? There is no legal advice. The tax issues that we discussed aren't covered. If there are separate or community property issues, those aren't going to be covered in those types of trusts. There's no Medicaid planning involved, no trust for special need beneficiaries. So there's a lot of things, and this is just something I came up with in about 2 minutes, thinking about these trusts that I've seen. No funding or comprehensive transfer document involved. I was reading today, I was reading something about the Susie Orman package, that you can get a trust package for $20 or something, and I was reading some of the reviews by people who had bought this. And if you look at that, there's one review that says, "This is the best thing ever. I was able to do my trust in 10 minutes. Everything that I need to know about trust, I was able to get from this package and prepare my trust in 10 minutes. I was thinking, I must really be an idiot, because I've been doing this for 15 years, and I go to classes all the time. I'm still learning and things change all the time. So I could have just gone and picked up that package and learned everything I needed to know in 10 minutes. I've wasted a lot of time. But obviously, not knowing what you don't know can be a big problem. It's like the Titanic, right? The iceberg that the Titanic hit, the reason they hit the iceberg was only 10% of the iceberg is above water, right? The problem, what they didn't see, was the 90% that's under the water. It's kind of the same thing with estate planning. It's the 90% of the issues that come up are things that you wouldn't even know were issues if you tried to do this yourself. So be very careful. By the way, I do have people come into my office, and if you do go to a lawyer, this is the guy you want to avoid. As you see, it's an attorney sitting in the office reading the will. And the final line is, "And finally, I leave everything to my lawyer." So that's the guy you don't want to go to. So I want to thank you very much. This is a picture of my beautiful staff other than me, including my wife, who I see has entered the room. Sue, I met at Hart High School way back. We met when we were 16, so that had to be like 10 years ago, right? but she actually runs my office. So I want to thank you all for showing up tonight. I hope there was some valuable information that you received. But before you leave, there's something that I want to offer you. First of all, I told you one of the goals when I do these presentations was that everyone hopefully learn at least one new thing they didn't know before they came. So is there anybody, and you can be honest, that really didn't learn anything tonight? It was a waste of time? Okay. I see my wife raising her hand back there. Okay. she's only seen this 120 times at least. So hopefully you did learn something, and you learned something useful. There are many traps and pitfalls out there for people in this area of law that can cost you and your family a lot of money. So be very careful. As I mentioned earlier, once again, you're not going to learn everything you need to know from these seminars, going online, reading books. You have to take action. There's a lot of information on my website, which is listed on the folder that you have. It's www.armorlaw.com, A-R-M-O-U-R-L-A-W. A lot of information on there. I encourage you to look at that. But all of this information, and to do this correctly, requires a detailed analysis of your specific situation, your assets, your wishes, to make sure it's done right. So to get you over the procrastination and get you moving in the right direction, here's what I offer. People that have me come to speak, I offer a complimentary consultation to anyone who shows up and wants to take advantage. And it's a two-hour consultation, because I'm going to need at least 2 hours. And people tell me, our situation is simple, it's going to take 15 minutes. It's not. Even if it's simple, it's going to take 2 hours. because I don't know what your situation is. I go through a very comprehensive checklist with you. It'll take me about an hour and a half to 2 hours to go through that checklist just to be able to advise you on what I think you should do. Now, I've had several people come into my office recently, and I went through the evaluation, and they really didn't need a trust. And I can tell you how to do, rather than go to We the People or Susie Orman, if there's something very simple that you need, there are forms out there that have been approved by the legislature. They're called California statutory forms. There's a statutory will. There's a statutory durable power of attorney. I will give you those forms or show you how to get them for free if that's all you need. There's the health care directive that everybody needs. I will give that to you for free. So don't feel bad about coming in and you think you're going to waste my time. If I can help you, I'd be glad to do that. Now, I will then, after that consultation, be able to advise you on whether I think you need a trust and then exactly how that trust should be set up. And if you want to set up an estate plan, you'll know exactly how much it's going to cost, because after the evaluation and gathering all the information, I'll be able to tell you exactly how much it's going to cost if you want me to prepare those documents for you. And then you can decide if you want to move ahead or not. And if you don't, there's absolutely no obligation to do anything. So does anybody have any questions, any general questions? Yeah, Bob.
You mentioned the exemption for avoiding taxes,
the estate tax exemption, yes.
Is that applicable if you have a trust? Doesn't the trust avoid any of those taxes anyway?
No. The trust is actually tax neutral when it comes to most taxes. So what the trust does allow you to do, if we go back to the old law that doesn't allow the deceased spouse's exemption to be transferred, is it will allow you to use both exemptions, but the trust doesn't avoid taxes. The trust allows you to use all the exemptions that are available, but the trust essentially is tax neutral. You still have to pay the tax if the assets in your trust are over the exemption amount. The assets held in a revocable living trust are still your assets for purposes of estate taxes. Another misconception out there with trust is if I put assets into my trust and I get sued, that my creditors can't touch the assets in the trust because they're not owned by me, they're owned by the trust. That's also not true. Your trust, a revocable living trust, where you've set it up so you're the trustees or the managers of your trust during your life, and you can change the trust anytime you want, including the right to revoke it, those assets in the trust are your assets for purpose of any creditors as well. It doesn't give you any credit protection, and it doesn't avoid paying taxes if you're over the exemption amount.
So an individual gains no benefit from the tax exemption law in the trust versus whether they had the trust or not, right? So the only financial benefit at that point is the avoidance of probate.
Well, there's the avoidance of probate. There is the management. Well, depending on the situation, if I have a client who has over a $5 million estate and they're single, or their assets could increase to that amount, or we don't know what the estate tax exemption is going to be in the future, and say they have a large life insurance policy, that's why we have to do this evaluation, because the revocable living trust wouldn't save them taxes, but we could set up something, say, called an ILID, an irrevocable life insurance trust, to take that life insurance out of their estate, so that's not going to get taxed. So the trust is not going to give them any additional exemption. So you're right in respect that if their estate is under the exemption amount, there's not going to be any tax benefit. And all of these things that I mentioned don't apply to everybody. So it may be that the tax stuff is irrelevant for you, or certain areas that we discussed don't apply. But that's why, I don't know. And there may be other things that I didn't get a chance to discuss tonight that would be more important to you. So that's why we need to do an individual consultation and evaluation of your situation. And I'll tell you what the benefits are. And then based on that, you can decide what you want to do or not do. Okay? All right. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, That's a very good question. I'm actually glad you brought that up. This is one of the things that I don't get into depth in the seminar like this, but very important. One of the most important assets we need to look at are those large, retirement accounts. There are some very interesting tax implications because the tax on those have been deferred. Whoever takes the money out has to pay, whether it's you during your lifetime or your beneficiaries after you pass away. So if you have those accounts, there are a lot of issues that we look at. One is, if you're going to name your trust as the beneficiary, we want to make sure that your trust contains some very specific provisions. Most trusts you should not name as the beneficiary because most trusts don't contain the right tax beneficiary tax provisions. So what we want to do is we want to look at that, look at the beneficiaries, and then determine whether or not it would be best to name the trust as the beneficiary. And if so, we want to make sure there's provisions that would still allow the beneficiaries to do things like what we call stretch that out. It's a stretch IRA or beneficiary or inherited IRA to allow beneficiaries to stretch out payments over their lifetime rather than having to take all of that out up front upon your death and pay all the taxes immediately. And if you set up trust for children or other beneficiaries, there's other language that needs to go into the trust to allow that stretch to take place. Most trusts don't have that language. Most financial advisors are trained to tell people, do not name your trust as the beneficiary because of those tax implications. But for somebody that knows what they're doing, we can build into the trust, in most cases, provisions that would still allow your beneficiaries to stretch out the payments and also stretch out the taxes for the beneficiaries. But that's something that has to be looked at very carefully. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? I want to thank you very much. Brad, I want to thank you for having me tonight, and I'll stick around, answer any questions that you have. Oh, there is one thing. I mentioned that I'm going to offer you each a complimentary consultation, right? But I don't know who you are. And as you found out earlier, I have a bad memory when it comes to meeting people. He introduced himself to me, and 5 minutes later he came up and I introduced myself again. But so I won't remember who you are. I have my staff in the back. Sue and Michelle are in the foyer there. If you want to make an appointment to see me, please go back and see Sue and Michelle. They will write your name down. And if you don't have your calendar, your spouse is not here, you don't know what your schedule is, just tell them. Just put me down. Give them the green sheet. They're going to collect a green sheet from all of you that has your name, address, phone number on there, and then they can contact you and we can change the date. But to take advantage of the complimentary consultation, you have to let them know so they can get you on the list or on the calendar. Once again, they have my appointment book down back there. They can make the appointment or they can take your name and contact you to set the appointment for you. That way you can take advantage of the complimentary 2-hour consultation. Okay. Once again, I want to thank you very much.